Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 64, featuring, do you know his name, Sean and Melissa? Do you know who it is?
No, because you've got it in the notebook.
Yes, I do.
I forgot it already.
It's Dominic Albanese. Who works?
Oh, it's Dominic Albanese.
Yes, that's correct, Sean.
No, thanks.
Yeah.
I was listening.
You were. He works at Direct Dimensions in Baltimore. So this is one of my old Baltimore podcasts that I've been keeping in the background for a while. Right. Mm-hmm. They're really cool. Do you know what Direct Dimension does?
Is it Can you tell us what Direct Dimension does, Chris?
Yes. They are a scanning company, 3D scanning. And they scan just about everything, and they have been doing it for about 20 years. So they've been doing it for a long, long time. And I sort of talk about that history where they used to have the old plot scanners where you basically had this big arm where you find things in space and plot it one by one, and now it's all done with lasers and photography and photogrammetry. And he talks about the history of digitally scanning stuff, which is kind of cool. What I really like the most about this podcast is that it covers so many industries. So architecture, VFX, facial stuff, all kinds of things. Another cool thing is that Dominic is a huge fan of the podcast itself.
So he might be listening then.
Yeah. I hope that he is listening. Yep. In fact, one point he had asked when Gina went to visit them, and he said, I haven't heard you in the podcast in a while. Why aren't you on? And so we have to explain to Dominic that Gina has been very busy today, and she was stuck in the rain. And so we've been all at work. And so Melissa and Sean decided
to join. So you're saying we're the sloppy seconds?
No. No. We're just changing it up a little bit.
Thanks, Chris.
So it's really cool. You know, one of the cool things he talks about, they do facial scanning in a really interesting way. They work with John Hopkins University to do facial prosthetics for people who have facial deformities or different things like that.
Very cool.
Which is very interesting and really falls deeply into my whole digital human stuff that's been pretty interesting, just understanding Uncanny Valley, because they really deal with it in a very real sense. So I was really fascinated by all of that. Anyway, these guys are really cool. They're good friends with Corey, as we who we know back in Baltimore. And he's always been sort of telling me, he's like, hey, you really should check out what they're doing at Direct Dimension.
It's amazing that they've been going for that long. I mean, are they one of the founders of the
technology? They've been doing it since kind of the beginning of the industry, and sort of been going along and making that happen for a long time. So really, really like chatting with them and sort of seeing all the different use cases for it, which I'm sure if you guys listen to this, you guys will be very interested in that as well.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
A lot of people think about scanning as fairly commonplace almost, right? But you guys have been doing it how long?
We've been doing it for 20 years.
20 years. Okay. So get a little closer.
Yeah, 20 years.
20 years. Okay. So, and you've been doing it, what was your first industry you guys get involved in?
Basically aerospace. So we came out of the aerospace tooling market.
Right.
And, you know, sort of went from there. So sort of started small and then, you know, branched into art and architecture and eventually VFX and all those other things.
All kinds of stuff. What was cool about what you showed us is that, that it's a lot of surprise cases, right? That's kind of it's kind of one of those interesting things. Like now that we have scanning available to us, like all these interesting things, it's not necessarily like, well, give us a scan of this and you'll have that. So it's almost like every time you scan something, you're solving a different problem.
Totally. Yeah. And it's, you know, that's the beauty of it is that, you know, we solve this one problem for our engineering clients and then all of a sudden that same problem pops up in the art world. So we get to sort of leverage that sort of knowledge across multiple industries.
Right.
Sort of, as we sort of went and started to branch out in all these different industries, we sort of found all these nice little cross-pollination things.
Okay. So with 20 years of scanning, How has the technology changed?
Oh my gosh, everything has changed. The hardware's gotten better. It's gotten cheaper. We've gotten better.
Okay.
The software's gotten better.
But isn't it, so how does the feedback work for you guys? Since what was like some of the first scanning materials? What was the first scanning method that you guys used?
So we started with something called the FaroArm, which was a 7-axis, I think it's called a goniometer or something like that, that came from the medical world.
Okay.
And
what was it used for in medical?
In medical, it was used for scoliosis. So in this company, it went from basically making, 100% making scoliosis measuring machines to within 2 years after being introduced to the aerospace market, doing 100% industrial.
So this basically measuring how much your spine is curved?
Exactly. Yep.
So you take this device that's used for medical purposes, shows people how much you scanned, and then suddenly now you're making propellers for, and turbines and stuff. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it was backbreaking work back then. You have to manually hold this device, and it's got a little ball at the end, and there's a 7-jointed arm, and it does the math to figure out where the center of that ball is. And as you move it through the volume, you can get your dimension. But you have to point it to the exact right spot. You have to touch the object. You only get a point every time you touch the object.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get a engineering surface, actually it worked great. You can get your planes and your holes and your tooling balls and all that stuff, but you can't get the shape of the object. So that was probably the first big jump in technologies. We went from doing that, and we would do things all the way up to giant airplanes doing that. Whereas every time you got out of the 8-foot volume of the arm, you'd have to leap it down the airplane. So in order to scan an airplane, you'd have to do this in 40 positions, and it would take you 6 days.
Right.
Which was a thing, but it was good. And then they started to be able to scan. So, and I think the distinction there is that scanning is, instead of just getting that one point every time you touch or is when you get close,
right,
you can both not touch it and you can get thousands and eventually millions and millions of points that describe the full shape of the surface.
Okay. So you're getting, in a sense, the plotting, I mean, you can almost call it plotting the first way, right? So you're plotting point, point, point. You're designating each point. Now it's literally just giving you a cloud of points.
A cloud of points. And actually, it's interesting. You used to have a lot of intent when you're doing the scanning because you had to say, okay, I think there's a plane here. Go pick it up. I think there's a hole here. Go pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And now in scanning, you just say, capture the object. It's not quite that easy, but you go and say, capture the object.
Mm-hmm.
And now when you come back to the post-processing step, you can look back and say, okay, we've got this this cloud of points here that describe the full shape of the object. And then you can analyze it sort of after it.
Yeah. Well, that's really, really kind of, that's very interesting. I think that there's a lot of, there's a lot of ways to look at it. Here's my first foray into scanned materials was actually on my first movie, which was Day After Tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was all LiDAR scanned, like they scanned all the library area. And what was interesting is that I was like, this is very accurate information, super great, and turns out it's not necessarily very accurate. There's a lot of noise.
Yep.
Right? So noise is an issue, and noise is basically just like noise in a camera. You see noise in a camera, right?
Yep.
Scanning has noise too, but that translates into three dimensions.
Depth. Yeah,
it's depth. Right. So there's depth and all sorts of other stuff involved. And so there's a process that obviously they had to do to take what was scanned information, where they would take a laser and scan an entire building, and I have to actually give that to an actual person to translate that into something usable, right?
Yep.
That process still exists today.
That process still exists today, and that's why we have 30 people here, working at Direct Dimensions doing that. That's what we do is, we can go out and take the scans, but then you have to interpret that data and somehow make that valuable for whatever process you're going to make that valuable from.
Right.
So, and that's a person going through that noisy cloud of points, and it's gotten less noisy over the years, but they still have to interpret. So if they're doing an architecture building, they have to say, here's a wall here, or maybe this wall is plain, orthogonal to this wall, or it's not supposed to be. Maybe we're doing an as-built, and you really do care about the different minute angles that are off. So it really still takes that human interaction.
And I think what's interesting in the human interaction, and that happens on both sides, obviously someone has to know what they're doing when they're scanning, and someone has to know what to do when they're cleaning up the data, right? So that becomes really interesting because to me, you're only as good as the people behind the company. The scanners are not necessarily going to solve all your problems.
No. There are a lot of people that do scanning these days. And I think the reason that we still are around and we're still relevant is because we have people that have all been here for 10, 12 years. We've got a whole slew of us that have been here for a long time. And it's that knowledge doesn't go away.
Yep. Yep. I remember specifically when we're starting with this company and they were like touting the technology of their LiDAR scanning. And then they came back to us and there is a slew of artists that they hired because there was so many buildings that they had to scan in New York. Mm-hmm. And we quickly figured out that like, oh, this is not like some automated system. Obviously there's an artist behind this. And it's like, oh, I got one from the loser again. We knew like which models were created by someone who was not very experienced and which one's like, oh no, I got a good one this time.
You got the
like,
good one.
Yeah, because we even after we got the building, we still had to UV map it, texture it, all that stuff, which was not part of their bid. We just got a clean model. So knowing how the artist is and what makes an artist really good and connection between those two is interesting.
Yeah, and it's actually some of the trickier parts of our job here is to know not only how far we should take it, but what that exact handoff should be to how we deliver it.
And so you obviously developed a relationship with all those clients to say, okay, this guy wants this kind of model, et cetera. Yep.
And that's very personalized, you know, across industry, but even inside of industries, you know, different people will want it in different flavors. And
yeah.
So it really is sort of a case by case basis.
Right. And so let's talk a little about some of the different areas or industries involved with architecture. We'll start with that because that's something that
you guys are all architects.
We're all architects. but I like the idea that architecture is something that is obviously scanned, right? So let's talk about the use cases of scanning architecture and why that's important.
And I think the main one would be the as-built model. So, you know, these days we've got Revit. You know, we design our buildings in Revit and we go out and we build them. But what is built in real life does not always match.
Yeah, Bob's contracting company does not necessarily
follow the drawings. and even more, the historical buildings and a lot of today's building construction world is taking an old warehouse and putting new loft apartments in it.
Yep.
And I can guarantee you that those walls are not square.
No. I live in California. There's nothing square in California. Thank you, Earthquake
Thank
City.
You, Earthquakes.
Yeah. At my old condo, we tried to put a door in and it like... I think there was about a 2-inch difference between one side of the doorway and another side.
You can tell
and this is a building that was built in the 80s. You know, it's like not even that old, but it's like nothing's straight in California.
Yeah. So a ton of that work is, you know, in that sort of long range, we're using the same tools that we would use for the day after tomorrow. As we go out there with our spherical scanners and we put them all over the place and we capture the data. But then the real magic again is coming back here and interpreting that for whatever the client needs.
Right.
So either making the as-built or... You know, sometimes they don't want that, and they do want like the squared up.
Right, but then you have to go into like vent spaces and scan that stuff.
Yeah, especially for when you're trying to somehow marry existing building plus what you're going to build.
Right,
and you have to we did a job for a hospital down here where they had to match up all of the oxygen pipes and vents, and the unit could only be shut down for a day. So. They couldn't shut down the unit. You know, they're building right next to it, and they couldn't shut down the unit. So we have to go up there above the vents, you know, waving our little scanners above the ceilings, trying to get as much as we can before we come back and do all the analysis.
Yeah, I know. It's when I'm on set and I have to get an HDR, right? And if the second, the AD, the assistant director, I don't know. Let me clarify that. Tristan's here. Tristan's joining us on the podcast. Thank you so much. So I'm going to explain to you what it's like to be on set, right? If you're on making a movie. The person you want to be friends with is not the director. The person you want to be friends with is the assistant director. Because the assistant director is actually the person running the show. The director is just there to make his vision, right? Or her vision. The assistant director is the one that actually keeps the schedule, goes, matches the whatever the shot list is supposed to be, makes sure that everything is ready for the next shot. So it manages all the lighting, manages all the grips, manages all the set, the props, make sure that everything is set up. If you're not friends with that person, you're not getting much time on set. And if you're going between one shot and another shot and you have to get an HDR, you want to have as much time as possible, but sometimes you have 3 minutes to get an HDR and get all the data that you want. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really hard. But you learn to operate fast in those conditions. I'm sure that's something that you've learned as well. You guys worked on set as well, right?
Yeah, we've worked on, I think, over 30 movies now.
30 movies, right. So, and that's very common to scan a full set.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All the time. I have now working in the movie industry, I'm like so spoiled the amount of data that I get. Mm-hmm. It used to be in the old days, like, I don't know, maybe there was a light over there somewhere. And now it's like, no, the light was exactly there. It was 13.75 meters away. Yep. And that's the intensity of the light. And that's exactly where it's positioned. And I have a wall here and I can construct the entire set based on scan data, right?
Yep, exactly.
And so that's what you guys do. How long do you guys take to scan a set? Do you guys?
Oh my gosh, it should just be a couple minutes
for, really?
For just doing like a rough sketch. I mean, that's not going to be the level of detail where you can get, you know, wrinkles in the, you know, in the on the brick wall or anything like that.
Right.
But we can do it quickly and get a really great model of the, you know, the full set.
So just to be clear, so originally it was 6 days with the Faro arm.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And now it's minutes.
And now it's minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, because you just go boom, you're just blasting the room with lasers.
And and now the problem is on the other side is before you didn't have enough data. And now you've got so much that you have to cull it down and swim through it and find the stuff that's actually valuable.
Right.
But it's always better to start with that than to start the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've gotten spoiled by it now. I got a lot more data, and to the point where, to be brutally honest, your goal on as a lighter, and some lighters may be upset at me for saying this, but your goal as a lighter is to match the lighting on set, right? Yep. And now the data that you're getting on set is so good that really shouldn't have to think too much about what you're doing anymore. You just match the lights and you'll be surprised how accurate it is.
Well, and all the rendering algorithms have gotten so good that basically if you put the lights...
It's physically based lighting.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't want to say how easy my job is, but when we were doing Real Steel, we had all the sets lights done, no problem, all taken care of. And so if you match that lighting, and it looked exactly like, what's his name? Who was the actor in Real Steel? What was his name? Hugh Jackman. So if you looked like Hugh Jackman and a robot was right next to him and it was like, done. I didn't have to do a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Even all the flashes, okay? So all the flashes that were going off in the stadium, we just basically had a pass where it was just all the flashes on at once, but each called out in a different light select system. So you could have an EXR that would individually do it. Mm-hmm. And then the compositor would just sort of sample the background plate for all the flashes and time random flashes to go off. And it would match the speed and everything. So it was a completely almost automated system of creating all the flashes that were going off the cameras. All the lighting was automatic to the point where I ran out of shots and I still had 3 weeks left to work on the movie. So on-set data is really huge, and it comes from both, you know, obviously scan data that you guys are giving, but also it's like a really good on-set VFX supervisor who can be really, really on top of things. And I know that, you know, the guys that I dealt with at DD and there's other places as well are really good. Again, it's the same thing. Good data gives you
good information.
But it's cool that you guys do other things as well. I didn't sort of want to sidetrack the VFX. And one of the other things that was really interesting to me is you had some historic building we're showing a picture of where you had these, it was like a dome and it had wood planks in there.
Yeah, and so we took, you know, scans of the wood planks and they were disassembling it to do renovation on it. But because it's a historic building, you basically have to reassemble it.
Exactly.
To the nail. So we were mapping individual nails to every single plank that built this, you know, 17th century dome, and then basically re-putting them back in so they could give them a map of how to reassemble this dome.
Did they use the same nails?
I think they did use the same nails.
Wow. Now that's crazy.
You go through a lot of hoops.
Yeah.
That is the definition of preservation.
Yeah, that's no, that is definitely preservation to the point of like, let's pretend we weren't even here. Yeah, so that's incredible. I mean, that's a great use case for it to think about. An unusual thought, you know, like, oh, how are we going to get this to make sure it's exactly right? It's like, well, we're going to scan it. And then we know exactly where it is. Because otherwise, the only other way would be to photograph everything and try to match and have a database. And
yeah, and then even the photographs are tricky because they don't always show everything. Right. Or you don't know the spatial dimensions between them. And
Yeah. That's a really, really cool cool use case. What are some of the other building stuff that you guys have done that was interesting?
Oh, man. I'm trying to think. Do a lot of facades for historical preservation. Some of the analysis stuff is pretty interesting, where we had people who have assembled pieces of architecture, you know, like a roof, a big giant roof that was getting assembled, and they were putting it together, and at the end, they assembled the whole roof together, and they come back, and the final bolts don't fit in the spots where it's supposed to go. And, you know, this is a very expensive roof in a very prominent location, so they want to get this solved as quickly as possible. And you have to know, is it...
And it's unusual shaped pieces, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. So nothing, you know, architects these days, nothing is straight. So we scan the whole thing and we're able to compare what exists in the real world to the, you know, the model that was supposed to be a design. And it can, what comes out of that is not, you know, sure we make the 3D model, but really at the end of the day, all they want to know is where location wise is it sort of warping. Mm-hmm. So you come, you get a color map out that sort of says, hey, these are the places where you're really starting to have problems.
Right. Interesting.
And you really can dissolve, you know, that 3D data that used to be, you know, 100 million points of stuff. We went out and scanned for days trying to figure all this stuff out. And at the end of the day, we give you a JPEG that shows you where some red spots are and where some green spots are.
Right.
And you've got everything you need.
Right.
So it is amazing how distilled this data can get by the end of the day.
Well, that's cool. And you guys obviously work a lot in the art world as well. Art is, how much, like from what I saw in your stuff, you guys, how much is the percentage of artwork? I mean, either scanning and preserving art or creating art as well.
Yeah, and it's probably equal amounts of both. I would say easily a quarter, maybe a third of what we do is in the art world. And it's both, you know, preserving art, which is sort of the stuff that you might think of off the top of your head. So whether you're, you know, going to a museum, doing a scan, creating that for preservation, or maybe we'll go through and we scanned a Caligula that had his arm broken off. Well, you know, classic.
You mean the sculpture.
The sculpture, not the actual guy.
Well, you never know. You are talking about Caligula. So.
Yeah, exactly. No, throwing people to the lions. But then we actually went back and also went through with a PhD who knows how they painted all the things and repainted it with the PhD to say, okay, this is the kind of paint they would use and this method of painting they would use.
Interesting.
And so go back in ZBrush and actually use the same kind of brush strokes that they would use in the, and we went and resculpted the arm with the help of the, so you end up with both a digital preserve model, but then you also end up with sort of a, you can take it farther than you could have just taken the picture.
So are you guys putting the arms back on Venus de Milo?
not yet. So there's that side of things, which is the preservation side of things, but there's also the fabrication from beginning.
Right.
So either, you know, there's the, a lot of the time something is going to get larger or smaller.
Okay.
So we have a lot of, you know, in scan, that's easy. You know, you scan the model and you push a button and all of a sudden it's five times bigger.
Right.
To make a, you know, a complex sculpture five times bigger by hand is a very tricky and sort of fraught process.
Right.
And then we're able to remake the physical piece at a different scale, either using rapid prototyping or five-axis machining or those kind of things.
Right.
So we do a lot of art that way.
Well, that's kind of cool. I love the idea of scaling up art, right? So there's some really cool stuff that you can do when you scale stuff up.
And there's problems when you scale stuff up too, because all of that little noise that we talked about.
It was, right. It amplifies. Now it's like a little mountain, right?
Exactly. And some artists love that, actually. And some artists actually love the process to be in the final output, too. So if they want to know that scanning was a part of their process, you preserve those things sometimes.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's interesting that people want to preserve that a little bit. I think sometimes people embrace the default part of material of the technology a little too much. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a professor of mine in architecture school, and I was helping him build one of his designs, and I was using Wavefront at the time. He wanted to do it in Wavefront. I don't know why, just because he wanted to be different, I guess. And I was the only person that knew how to do Wavefront, and so he asked me to model it in Wavefront. And the default color in Wavefront is like a aqua blue kind of color. And it's like, yes, I love that. It's like, that's just the default color. It's like, it's not that I chose that color. It's like, yeah, no, that's the perfect color. It's like, anyone who's used this software will tell you that that's just the default color. So just embracing the default and embracing the defects of it, I think that's fine, I think, to a point. But I think, you know, after a while, people are just going to look at it and say, that looks 3D printed, right?
Exactly. And actually, the 3D, and the same thing in the MakerBot land, our little tiny 3D printer, people are making these sculptures of when the prints fail a lot, not a lot, but sometimes. And then people would get these little nests of extruded glue and making these little bird cages. And they were saying, oh, look, it's so beautiful. It's my perfect little 3D printed art failure.
Right.
But it's always more interesting when you actually are trying to do the thing you're trying to do.
Right, of course. Yeah. Yeah. I remember this. One of the first 3D printer things I used was something that uses plaster. Mm-hmm. What was it called? Z Corp was the company. I think it was called Z Print or something for the printer.
Yeah, we still have them.
You still have them?
We have a whole bunch of here on the wall.
Okay. Well, That process is basically just lays down a very thin layer of plaster and then a binding agent, usually water.
Or super glue.
Or super glue, and just puts it down there, and then it's just the powder is bound and not bound. Well, we were trying to do one, a sculpt. Actually, who was it? Office Depot? Was it Office Depot?
Oh, yeah, they were going to put them in there.
They had all these printers, like, you can get your 3D print done at the Office Depot. And so
Staples, I think it was.
Staples. Yes. And so we took one of the models from Nino with Miguel's models, and he's like, yeah, it's great. And I was like, the only thing, Miguel, it's got to be watertight. It's like, it's watertight. It's like, okay. And I don't have time to go through his model, right? Because it was an insane, it was one of those... one of his characters in the underwater suit, like the old 1900s water suit. It was all just kind of crazy thing. And I looked at it and I was like, it says it's not watertight in Max, but we'll go with the STL file anyway, and sent it over to Staples. And it's like, yeah, well, we should print this, no problem. And by the way, when I went there, it was day one when they were offering service.
Always a good plan.
Always a good plan.
Always a good plan. Like,
what could
this
go
won't
wrong?
Fail.
What right. could go wrong? What could go wrong? And so I came. He's like, it'll be ready tomorrow morning. I was like, great, I'll come by. And I came back, and it was just these crumbles of like, it's just like, there was kind of a head here, sort of, and the rest is just powder. So it is kind of hard to think about that and making things watertight. Like, you guys have tools for all that stuff, I'm sure.
We've got tools for all that stuff. And that printers are getting slightly better at sort of solving and glossing over. If you can cut the cross section through, it still will do it, even if it's not watertight. But yeah, it can be tricky. We actually did it for a movie model that somebody wanted to take. I think it was a Transformer, and they wanted to actually make it into a printable action figure. So we got the 3D Max model that was being used in the movie.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for that to be watertight for all the VFX shots.
So no.
We spent many a long hour, closing off the 4,000 plates.
Yeah, I've seen Transformer models. it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why a truck has 8 carburetors in it, because it looks cool as a shoulder pad, but it doesn't really actually need 8 carburetors. It's kind of interesting, that whole process, of doing that. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, something that I know that you and I are both interested in is digital humans and body scanning and stuff like that. So how has that changed over the years? You guys have done a lot of that, right?
We have, and I think we probably started, oh my gosh, if I had to put a number on it, 14 years ago,
right.
Scanning, I think we scanned Ray Lewis
from
the Baltimore Ravens for a fundraiser.
Okay.
With a non-contact laser, and we made a bust, and we auctioned it off at the... but that was a slow process, and it was also, we were using a laser, which we don't really like to shine in people's eyes. It took, 10 scans. What could go wrong? He's not worth, money.
Yeah.
And plus then we'd have to put all the scans back together, and it took a long time, and it took, weeks at that point to put all that stuff together.
Sure.
And we've sort of come along until we can get, scans of people in the instant of a flash at this point. So we have a photogrammetry rig. There are several of them out there these days, but we have a rig of 80 cameras that does full body, passive stereo photos, and it can either do heads or it can do bodies.
Yeah.
And so you walk in, you push the button, and you get not a model out, but you get all the pictures out necessary to create the model instantly.
Right.
So that's a real
step forward. Cameras are good at taking pictures now.
Cameras are good at taking pictures. And the nice thing is, we get to leverage Canon, doing all of their development, without having to wait for the, 3D scanning manufacturers are not exactly Canon and Nikon in terms of like the land of making new equipment.
Right.
So we get the advantage of the much faster recycle sort of technology cycle.
You can update
your
technology really quickly.
Yeah. Although, putting 88 new cameras in a rig, it's not something
we'd
like to do.
Okay. So let's talk about those cameras, because what was interesting about the cameras you saw, it's like they're not necessarily they're not a bunch of 5Ds out there or 1DXs, right?
Good gracious.
Yeah, because each one of those would cost you $3,000 or $4,000, right?
Exactly. And we're just using, sort of not cheap cameras, but, entry level DSLRs.
Right. But all you want is a picture.
All you want is a picture, and you want it to be reliable. And,
and if you have 88 of them, it's much better.
It adds up. And actually, the angles, having more cameras is actually better than having better cameras.
Yes.
Because it actually lets you see all the different angles and be able to reconstruct it better.
Did you see that? What was, sorry, I don't want to derail, but did you see that camera that came out recently that they put on Kickstarter or something like that called Light? And it's basically, it's supposed to be like a DSLR replacement, and it looks like a thick, mobile phone, like an iPhone or whatever.
Okay.
But it's got 16 cameras in the back of it.
Yep.
And it basically, because it's 16 slightly sensors. Lower resolution sensors, it'll reconstruct it into a very high quality image.
Yeah, I think it ended up being like 50 megapixels.
And redo the depth of field for you, and you can do low, and it, because it's, you know, if you do, you know, you take your cell phone, right? You take a picture outside at night, it's going to look pretty grainy. But if you take 16 of those same images,
yeah, and you stack them,
it looks really good.
It looks really good.
Yeah. A friend of mine, actually, you know, sorry, I didn't want to do relevant, but I want people to understand this. A friend of mine went out there. He took with his normal Canon camera, 7D, right, and a zoom lens. He put it on a tracking system for, you know, basically a, so you can track the sky, stars, and took 30 pictures of Andromeda.
Okay.
And stacked them together.
With a 7D.
With a 7D. And basically each picture was 30 seconds or something like that. And caught the most beautiful, clear, perfect picture of Andromeda. Each individual picture looked like crap, right? Think of it like rendering. Let me just put it that way.
Sure.
It's the same problem as rendering. If you have a rendering with really low samples...
You get a noisy
image. But if you do, if you keep the image going 30 times, those samples get better and cleaner and cleaner.
The signal pops out.
The signal, You get rid of the noise and you get much more signal. Yep. So it's really, I guess that's kind of the same thing you guys do with 88 cameras, right?
Yeah, sure. And actually, you know, those sensors already have 18 megapixels each, so they're already pretty high.
Oh, they're pretty dense.
They're pretty dense.
But the sensor size is smaller.
The sensor size is smaller, but we're also pumping a lot of light in. So we don't, you know, a lot of the nice bits of expensive cameras is they can take pictures in low light better.
Right.
But, you know, with a bunch of flashes, we're pumping a ton of light into that scene. There's not the same need to have high, you know, dynamic range sensors in terms
sure.
of capturing.
So do all the cameras go off at once?
All the cameras go off at once.
Okay. And what do you light with?
We light with just regular studio flashes. Right now, we're doing it just basically studio flashes through diffusers. So we basically approximate like a sky dome, right?
Right.
Same illumination from everywhere.
So you get as even light on the thing as possible.
And it's not yet, you know, de Bevec, like separating the diffuse and specular.
No, I understand.
But it's a pretty good start for getting just a, you know, an albedo map.
Right. And with a not too big a setup, you don't have light stage 6 or whatever, by the way, I think when they turn on all the lights on light stage 6, it blew to like the city block. So, which is a cool thing. But light stage 6 is pretty cool. I think you guys are a little bit different than that. But with a much smaller setup, which is portable, you guys can do full body scans.
And it's full bodies, and we can go there in a day. Yeah.
Right. So different use case for sure. But allows you guys to basically do photogrammetry pretty evenly and pretty cool. And you can get some level of color, obviously. You get just whatever.
Oh, yeah, we get great color.
Right.
And, I mean, if we want to, we can make 16K texture maps.
Right.
But, you know, they're going to have the diffuse and specular burned in together.
Right.
Although, you know, that...
Can't you put polarizers on everything and just...
We could do polarizers with everything and, you know, flip them around. But then we have some other... Actually, there's some new research by de Bevec doing... he's got a 24 camera rig. I think it's called the Flash Mob, where he does a different separation mechanism by looking at you light from different views.
Sorry,
you get different
this.
Lights. You get from different lights. So it's, I think it's 24 cameras, 6 shots, and 6 different lighting conditions.
Right.
And you can do a combination of photometric and do the diffuse specular separation that way.
Right.
So like something that we could definitely think about implementing.
Yeah.
Our set of things.
Yeah, it's cool. I love that idea. You know, scanning people is very interesting, and holding a pose is challenging.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to take, you know, a hand scanner out there. It would basically take, you know, 10 shots a second, and we were getting a patch, and you'd have to go run around and wave this thing at them. And
so that, and say, please don't move, right?
Please don't move. And you know what? Stunt doubles are great at not moving. Lead actors are less good at not moving all the time.
I'll tell you. There's a certain actor that we scanned who also happens to do his own stunts. So maybe this is the reason. But he can hold a pose, man.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah. And if I ask for neutral, it looks exactly the same. Even if I ask for him like 2 hours later, it's still the same pose. Yeah, he was
He was amazing at holding a pose and doing stuff. So yeah, that's kind of cool. And it is tough because I've seen people that are like, whoa, the shiny light's too much for me. You know,
yeah, people that are eating their slice of pizza in the middle of the scan kind of thing. And, you know, photogrammetry will do amazing things, but it will not reconstruct
a slice
of pizza. A slice of pizza. Well, we'll do that.
We will, but you don't want to add that.
You don't want to add the pizza.
Because otherwise there's like a slice of pizza in every shot that's always there.
So just out of curiosity, so when you scan that actor, do you use one camera, two cameras?
So it depends on the setup. You know, the rig is a lot to go to somewhere to scan one expression of one actor.
Right.
So depending on the job, we'll go up and set that up for, you know, a week or a month or whatever the job requires. Every once in a while, we will go and run up with a single camera and run around quickly and do single camera photogrammetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be as high resolution. It's not going to be as robust in terms of being able to run around and being able to make sure that that person was exactly still for that time.
Right. But you do have your full body scanners though, right? So you do have that kind of...
Yeah, and we'll still use the hand scanner, full body scanner, to basically run around and get a body. And that works pretty good. And actually, you can combine the two techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So if the photogrammetry might be failing because of the little bit of motion, the full body scanner will get a decent model, and then we can reproject the nicer color from the photogrammetry.
Okay.
So we can sort of mix and match and figure out what the best, you know, segments are.
Yeah. But do you still use the hand scanner?
Yeah, we still use it. And you know,
it fits in a little backpack
that's a check bag.
It's like a check bag. You go in there, it's like, great.
Yeah, whereas the rig is, you know, a van and a couple guys in a day to set up.
I have a really weird story for you. It's a perfect Scott Metzger story. And if those of you who know who Scott Metzger is, which is a lot of people, he went to on set somewhere. And he had one of those scanners because he was, you know, scanning everything. And he met this person there, this girl at a bar. And he said, hey, want to come back to my place and I'll take a really expensive picture of you? So he created a scan of her. Like he did a full thing. And then he went back to her like a few days later, saw her at the bar again. And he did a full render of her in V-Ray as a marble statue.
Did that work long term for him?
It actually did work.
Oh.
But it was such, if you know Scott, that's like exactly the kind of thing that he would do.
Married and they have three scan kids. I'm just kidding.
He's like, but I love the pickup line. You want me to take a really expensive picture of you?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was pretty funny. But yeah, those things are really awesome because like that wasn't around too long ago. When did those things start coming up?
Oh man, probably in the last 3 or 4 years. So yeah. You know, it used to be that photogrammetry was an expensive proposition and sort of the algorithms were sort of locked up.
Is that photogrammetry? No, it's scanner.
Oh, the which?
The hand scanner.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, and those are probably about the same age range. But
right.
Patch-based scanners have been around for a while. And even the very first scan we did at Ray Lewis all back in the day was a patch scanner. It just happened to
what
do
it.
What
does patch scanning mean? Explain that so that people know.
So instead of getting... So there are spherical scanners, which we used for architecture.
Basically just like a LiDAR, which is basically shoots lasers everywhere.
Yeah, and you get a spherical globe of point cloud.
Gotcha.
A patch, you'll get a 2-foot by 3-foot chunk of scan data.
Right.
So in order to build something up like a human, you need to take a bunch of patches.
Right.
And it used to be that if you took, you know, 3 seconds to take a patch, that would be impossible for somebody to stay still for, you know, the minutes it would take to scan a whole person.
Mm-hmm.
But the newer patch-based scanners shoot at 10 to 15 frames a second.
And they automatically just...
And they're stitching the geometry frame by frame as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sort of building up the model as you go.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful because you can get lost and you can, if things change in the middle, we can get a little squirrely, but for the most part, they work really well.
Okay.
So it's stitching in real time. So it takes the patches and overlays and...
Yep, it's stitching in real time. And you can actually watch it on the screen, so you have to carry around, you know, you've got your scanner with you and you got your screen.
Now let's talk about going super cheap. So let's talk about people that are taking their cell phones now and doing, what is it? What's the Autodesk app for 123?
123 Catch.
123 Catch, right?
Yeah, I think the future of this kind of stuff is that scanning will become almost ubiquitous and everybody will scan all the time and probably won't even know it. The other one that's actually interesting is the Google Tango tablet.
That's right where I was. Google Tango is scanning everything all the time.
Scanning everything all the time. And I think they're...
I think Google wants to have more information about the world.
Yes. And the amazing thing there is you basically get indoor GPS. So by...
Right.
It's using the 3D data. And actually what I love about this is that the 3D data is there, but it's behind the scenes. You don't even know. I mean, you can get the point cloud out.
Right.
But really what it's trying to do is just position the device in space.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do AR stuff really nicely because it mm-hmm. knows where you are in space. You don't have to have a GPS. So it's sort of this mix of,
mm-hmm.
you know, inertial plus scanning.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that everybody will scan all the time. You know, I mean, there's already these sort of apps on Kickstarter. You go and take 6 pictures of your ear and you get custom made earbuds that fit your ear perfectly.
Really?
And I don't think that's quite scanning 100% yet, but I think that's not far off.
No, it's not scanning, but it makes sense.
It makes sense.
So you think that even those patch scanners will either have to get much, much better or will kind of not be useful anymore? Or
it's not that they won't be useful, and there will always be a slice of the marketplace for sort of industrial level scanning. Like, I don't think
of
that
course.
Our company is going to go away because we won't have jobs to do.
No. Like I said, it's still about the people, right? Because I can't ask, you know, some guy off the street to please bring your iPhone over and scan something and give me a model. That's just that someone has to know what kind of data people need and have to make that proper translation.
True, but I do think there will be a huge number of applications that will be powered by that low level of scanning.
Right.
And people won't even know that they're scanning. They're going to go and take, you know, they have 6 pictures of their face, and they're going to get a pair of eyeglasses that, you know, fit their face perfectly. Or they'll be able to go in their app, and they'll be able to flip through all the different eyeglass, you know, options and look at it on their 3D face and be able to see how they're going to look before they do it. And they won't even know they're scanning.
Right.
I guess they'll know they've gotten a model or something. But
and this is kind of what ShapeShot does, right?
Sure. Yeah, and we've sort of developed a little bit of a platform to start from the scan, but the scan is just the start, right? And at the end of the day, eventually, that is just the very beginning. Is capturing the data is going to be the easy part.
Right.
And then it's a matter of how do you turn that data into something that's useful for somebody.
Okay.
And the human body is amazing because we're in some ways, we're all the same. You know, 99% of us, we all have arms and legs and we have facial features. And yet we're all different and unique.
Right.
And so there's this... There's sort of a magic of sort of correlating the differences of people,
right?
Which scanning can give you all the time.
Sure.
But you're missing, how does that correspond to sort of what we would call like our generic human body? So when you scan, you get a cloud of points. And I have no idea that an eyeball is an eyeball or a nose is a nose.
Well, you do because you're seeing it.
I do, but the computer doesn't. Human brain.
Right.
The computer has no. So I think bridging that gap of taking scan data, which is great at capturing shape, but is sort of lacking the knowledge of the human form,
mm-hmm.
and sort of bridging that so that, you know, scans will know where eyeballs are, know where noses are, knows where the corners of your mouth are,
mm-hmm.
can really go a long way for especially that low end, but the scanning that's just done on your cell phone.
Right. Well, what was the example you were showing us today with a carpal tunnel brace, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you can envision a scenario where it's pretty easy, where you go into Walmart or whatever, you stick your arm in a tube, you get takes 50 pictures. I don't know what it is.
Right.
So you can, right now, that's easy to make a 3D model.
Yeah.
So we can all imagine how that could happen. The tricky part is, how do you say, I know exactly where to trim my arm to be able to make a perfect carpal tunnel brace that fits me.
Mm-hmm.
I can do it as an engineer. It takes me half a day. It's probably not worth it to do it for, you know, the 10,000 people or whatever,
yeah.
the people that need it. So you need to be able to figure out how can you make the computer understand that that's part of the arm or that's part of the hand,
mm-hmm.
and be able to do those trims automatically.
Yeah. In a, you know, 10 years from now, it'll 3D print it directly onto your arm in that same tube.
Yeah, exactly. And just
cut it. Come out like you come out, braces on there.
Braces
like
on there.
It takes your credit card when you put your hand in the machine.
No, it doesn't take your credit. That's all wired into the chip that's embedded in your fingers.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean that's kind of an interesting case. Now the other thing that fascinated me, and this is something that came up when I talked to Michael, I guess a while ago, is obviously you guys are doing a lot of facial scan, and as you know, you've been following some of the WikiHuman project that we've been doing. I think it's really interesting that, you know, we can take digital humans and we can try to bring back dead actors or whatever, and that's great. And that has driven a lot of the technology that has come out of visual effects in terms of digital humans, and that has funded that research in a sense. But the research of making digital humans is actually really interesting, and I think much bigger than that use case. And obviously, one of the biggest challenges that we always still talk about, the minute you say digital human, people talk about the uncanny valley. I'm not going to describe that for those who don't understand the uncanny valley. Those who would like to know what more about the uncanny valley, go back and listen to the Norman Seif podcast where I describe it in very big detail. Anyway, so that's really kind of an interesting use case. But one of the things that I thought was very interesting is the fact that you guys are involved with doing facial prosthetics. Explain that for a second, and I want to go into why I think it's important for digital human work.
Sure. So facial prosthetics are the sort of the technique of using our scanning technology to capture, you know, the face. And oftentimes in these cases, people, let's say the example of somebody's missing an eye. So they have sort of a void where you would normally have an eyeball. And so we're able to provide the, it's a digital anaplastologist is the sort of the name of the person who would go through and do this, and basically give them a model of the face. And they're able to use that data to construct a prosthetic that fits perfectly in the void that they've got. Mm-hmm. But it also, the outside surface is exactly a mirror of their other side of their face.
So which is sometimes weird. Sometimes you have to
change. Yeah, and so people are not, so that's part of the art of it is that, you know, our data is going to be a perfect mirror.
Right.
But this, we're not at the point yet where we can just hit a button and you get the orbital prosthetic. So there is an artist. There's an artist still involved.
See, and that's the thing that I think is really fascinating. But go ahead, keep going.
And so at the end of the day, they get a prosthetic that gets clipped in, and you've got basically a piece of silicon as the sort of end product at the day, and a little eye piece that looks correct.
And most people can't tell.
Most people can't tell. I can't tell.
Really? That there's a facial prosthetic involved?
I can't tell.
That's really, really cool. And some of them are pretty major facial.
Yeah, like, so you're not just like a little blemish or something.
Yeah, like someone, like a war veteran is an example, yeah. Right? So a war veteran comes back, has got part of his face blown off, and you cannot go out in public anymore, right?
Yeah, and in some cases, this is actually a harder use case than the movie stuff where we, you know, making a still, we can make a still that looks like a digital human, and I feel like it's pretty believable. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where we can do movies and we can make them look believable. But to actually have somebody walking around and you're interacting with them.
In three dimensions.
And, you know, talk about the Norman Seif stuff. Like,
right.
That you expect the emotion to be there. And especially when you've actually got the human in front of you, you expect that emotion to come out. So it really is a high bar.
Right.
So you really want to make sure that.
I find it fascinating because I think, to be honest, that is one of the best examples of an art form that has dealt with. I don't know even know if in that art form, and some people may not even call it an art form because I think it's a bridge between medical technology, engineering, and art, right? Mm-hmm. But that it's probably that last bit of the art form, the Norman Seif part of the podcast we're talking about, is that part that is able to cross that valley, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think if we just, you know, I can go to my cheap 3D printer and print that same orbital that we're going to make in silicon that he didn't touch,
right?
And it's creepy.
Of course it is.
It's completely creepy. So that's the part that's missing that really bridges the gap.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think that there's obviously ought to be it's a flexible silicone for a reason. One is it's got to feel correct, right?
Feel correct to the person as well. Otherwise, you know, if they don't interact with the prosthetic the right way, then they won't. Then the same, you know, the motion.
But it also has got to be rubbery enough so that it moves like skin, right?
Yeah, and it also can hold the color a lot better. You know, 3D printing and color is this famously fraught sort of issue still. So, so it's getting there.
That's interesting. And I think that the idea of doing prosthetics, to me, is an interesting portion of what could be happening in digital human work.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like you said, it's not just the making beautiful images on the screen, and it is driving the technology, and we're sort of the recipients of that.
Right.
But we're able to take that and say, okay, as we sort of make this model of digital humans, then we can. There are other applications out there that still need this data.
Right. Yeah, I think that there's this is exactly the kind of thing that I'm looking for in terms of finding definition of why digital human work is important. I think that looking at things like that use case is a perfect one. And I think the medical field across the board is interesting. I think the psychology part of it is really interesting. Speaking to Angela Tinwell, she was mentioning two different ways of looking at both as a receiver and as a person who has autism.
Okay.
So if you look at autism, in a sense, one of the problems with the struggles that people with autism have is they have a hard time reading emotions
yep.
off people. So what ends up happening is that they're doing studies with them with digital humans that are in the uncanny valley and seeing if they look any different to them than a normal human, and sort of understanding that psychological study of if the uncanny valley, if basically do people with autism constantly live in that uncanny valley? Is the valley
the whole world
to them? Right. Yeah. So that's a really interesting idea as well. It's like, wow, that's kind of an interesting thing. The other thing I think is because autistic people sometimes have a hard time reading emotion, they also have a hard time showing emotion. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling that sometimes the reason that we, when we see or we're interacting with someone with autism, we get a little bit freaked out a little bit. And is the emotion that we're feeling the same that we feel when we see something with?
So we're viewing them as
the uncanny valley. So I think there's a valley, there's an interesting part of that that could be really studied in a way. So, and I think that what's cool about what we're, you know, what I just saw in some of the prosthetic stuff is I think that that is a field that has to cross the valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is a field that does it every day and has to do it successfully or their job is not met. And I think that there's a lot of research that could happen in terms of the technology that's being done there. Obviously, like you said, it's like we can only go so far with technology and the scanning, et cetera. But then after that, you sort of rely on a specific artist's skill. Now, how big is that business? It's not...
Not huge. And I mean, he has other practices that, you know, as like a standard doctor and that he does on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
It's not like it's a side thing, but like it's a piece of what he does.
Right.
But it seems like you as a receiver of this prosthetic, your body changes, you get older and things happen. It seems like you're going to have actually a life cycle. Once you get into this, you have to kind of come back and do it again. So is this kind of part of the situation?
They certainly do come back and sort of get adjustments and stuff.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing that Angela said was she was talking about how in that artist part of it, that there is not a danger, but it's possible that they're imbuing their projection of themselves into the character too.
Yes.
And so I wonder, maybe we should ask, you know, ask Juan, our anthropologist, and say, like, is it, you know, like some of the more recent ones that, not really recent ones, but like the Tupac or the Paul Walker, it's almost like, those ones, they had such people behind them instead of just being like a movie character. It's almost like there's like this whole human emotion thing that was for both of those characters.
Yeah.
And I think that the artists who made those mm-hmm. were able to imbue that with a much more humanity than like the ones just for a movie, because there's so much extra emotion sort of surrounding those.
Yeah, but I think, you know, there was someone who made a comment. They were looking at the Paul Walker, the G-double for Fast and Furious, and they were saying, you know, the person that actually was doing the acting was his brother, right? And they said that they could sense more the brother than they could sense Paul, because that was the only reference they had, right? Mm-hmm. So it's hard. It's hard as like, okay, I'm going to pretend like I know Paul Walker and I'm going to pretend like I know, you know, ignore everything else that I have as a reference. So it's hard to do. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's going to be people that develop that art form or that skill set over time, but I don't know if that's going to be the case.
Yeah, it seems like a really tricky proposition.
It is, and I don't know. I mean, I know for, you know, when we were working on Clue for Tron, and, you know, when we had Jeff Bridges is a lot older, right? Mm-hmm. And we had to use him as reference. Now, I'm not saying anything, but, you know, Jeff Bridges' muscles and skin doesn't move the same way that it did, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So how are we expected to actually say, oh, you know, we can make, his facial motion is going to match whatever we reference, and it's hard for us to rejuvenate that. So the poor animators, honestly, poor, they have to go back and over and over and over again. There's something not right. There's something's not right. There's something
not
right.
It still requires the artist.
It still requires the artist, but there was no way. Everyone was looking for an answer, right? Mm-hmm. I'm still in the from the point of view, and you know, with good scanning mechanisms and good techniques, is reduce as many variables as possible.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with making the tech as good as it possibly can.
Right, because then you don't have to guess anymore.
Yep.
But what I don't like is when people take the technology or take the information they have and ignore it. At least know why it's wrong or what's going on. I'm just going to say, I can do it better on my own. Yeah. There's ways where there's technology that can give you good reference. And if something's not right, know why it's not right.
Sure. And this is the classic example of the Digital Emily, is that, you know, those shaders are there and those maps are there, not because they're suggestions.
No.
But because they're the actual measured reflectance values for the diffuse albedo.
I mean,
it's like they're...
I measured... That was the biggest frustration. We get these guys, you know, I don't want to say anything, but basically these people would get this data from ICT, and it's measured scientific data. We know it's exactly calibrated. We had a Macbeth chart there. We know exactly what that skin's supposed to look like. We know exactly how reflective every pore is supposed to be. We've got things scanned down to, you know, a 16K displacement map. Why are you saying, ZBrush will do a better job? Like... Why not at least start with that reference and say that is what the diffuse is supposed to be?
And there's still immense amounts of artistry, and it can happen after that.
There's lots of, I'm not going to try to take away, but there's a lots of information that the scanning doesn't get around the eyes very well, doesn't get around the mouth very well, or the nose. So you still have to sculpt that stuff. Ears are something I found out very quickly. If you don't get someone's ear looking right, it looks really weird. So ears are really, and very personal too, very, very personal. Like if someone has got a weird ear,
and
you're looking at that ear
scan.
A lot when you're having a conversation with them.
Yeah, they're not easy to scan either. Because
they got so many creases in there.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think actually all this stuff is even going to get harder again when we try and take digital humans into VR.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of stepping up the interactivity level a little bit, and all of a sudden you're not going to have this person sort of just acting at you, but also, you know, expecting to have a dialogue between whatever the digital human is.
Basically, it's the same prosthetic thing, right?
Exactly.
But it's a full face prosthetic, right?
Yeah, so I think it's even harder when you start to go into the interactive land.
Right.
To make that, to bridge that gap.
Yeah. I think it's awkward either way, because, I mean, I've seen some performances where they had, you know, the guys over at 8i, they do some really interesting work, and they're having full acting people in VR, right? So they do basically like a 3D video of them. It's pretty interesting. There's been a lot of press about them, so I'm not going to necessarily get too much into it, but it's a really interesting. The problem I have, and it's nothing wrong with their technology, the problem I have is that, and this is something I talk about with Kevin Mack, because he and I have had lots of conversations about the use cases of virtual reality. We, as a consumer of entertainment, are so used to that form factor where it's a TV screen or a movie and it's a third-party experience, right? Yep. You're looking at it and someone is telling you a story. So in that third-party experience, when someone's, you know, has a movie and they're telling you something, they can get into some really deep, deep stuff, right? And talk about horribly emotional things. And you're looking at it like, that's really crappy what happened to that person. But you're engaged in a movie, whatever. VR is a first-person experience. It's not a third-person experience. So if someone's sitting there and is basically... You've never met this person, you don't know who they are, and they're an actor coming up to you and telling you something, it's an awkward experience. Even if they're just telling you something completely, you know, a simple thing, having a live person there or having a person that seems live there is very odd. I think either way, it's going to have a different kind of uncanny valley problem.
Yeah, and there are whole new rules that will have to happen for storytelling and for framing and all that.
Because I don't think that you're going to tell stories anymore. Because I don't think VR is a proper way to tell stories.
Yep.
I think that VR is a proper way to experience things, right? Because storytelling is a third-person experience. Experiencing things is a first-person experience. So, you know, I don't go to the Basilica in Rome and go, tell me a story. I go there to experience it. And when I go into VR, I want to experience it as well, right? Mm-hmm. I want to see it. And it's, you know, Corey, we were talking about this the other day. That's why architecture is about experiencing space, right? Yeah. There is narrative in architecture. I'm not going to take that away because there's a narrative of how you move around a space, et cetera. And so you can get there, but it's not a story. It's an experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an important part of the VR world. And introducing people into that, we haven't figured out the story part of or how to what the role of a virtual person is.
Yeah,
I don't know what the role is, but it certainly is not someone telling you a story. I don't think in the same way. I think it's.
I don't think you're going to watch movies on a VR headset or have films. Yeah,
well, they are, and how are they doing it? They're putting a movie screen in front of you, which is the funniest thing in the world. But people love it because, oh, I feel like I'm in a movie theater. It's like, well, then just go to a movie theater. It's like, how hard is that? You know? And it's like, so, well, or it makes it look like you have a really expensive entertainment room in your house, and so you feel like a rich guy, right? So,
got it.
I don't know. There's some interesting things. Have you guys done any VR work? Have you guys gotten into that?
We have done a little bit of scanning to make VR work. I think we made a hotel downtown.
Oh, okay.
And we did a bunch of scans and we took a bunch of, you know, panos and right. Eventually we'd go into VR. But I think that one was to showcase the hotel's new, all their new architecture bits that they'd put in.
Okay.
And interestingly, I think that was like a conveyor belt sort of thing. So you could still look around, you know, 3D video. And I think it was pre-rendered.
Oh, it was 3D video. Okay.
Well, rendered content, but rendered stereo 3D.
Okay.
So you.
But it was stereo.
Was stereo because they built the model and gotcha. Then they took the VR headset on a conveyor belt through the space.
Right.
And during that time, you can, you know, look in any whatever
sure.
direction you want.
It's like being on a ride at
it's being
Disney
on like
World.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah. It's like
it's a small world. After
it's a
all.
Small world after all.
You're picking up exactly what I'm putting down. That's good. Yeah. So that was cool. So, and you think that that's going to start happening more these days?
I think for sure that VR is going to need real content. Not just created spaces.
Okay.
So beyond, I mean, I can imagine, you know, building some buildings to walk around in isn't super intriguing because, you know, building's a building. You can build it nicely in Revit. I don't think it makes that big of a difference. But maybe when you're going and looking at some of the sculptures in the Louvre, for example, mm-hmm. you want those sculptures to actually be close to the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can build those by hand easily. So I think scanning will have, you know, sort of a
sure.
an entree into sure. basically making the content for VR.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Yes, of course, of course. Of course that makes sense. I also think that there's, I think that there's a lot of scanning, of spatial scanning that's going to sure. be happening as well. I think people want to see
inside of the spaces.
Inside of spaces and what that looks like and what that experience is like. And I think that's going to happen down to the smallest, you know, cardboard level, right? People mm-hmm. are just going to look around and say, hey, yeah. Great.
And it's amazing how accessible the cardboard makes everything.
Yeah. It takes the computer you already have in your pocket and turns it into a VR headset. And there's nothing, you know, I was talking with Shane yesterday. He's like, yeah, I was poo-pooing cardboard for a long time. But then I was like, you know, a lot of people have it and it's not bad. It's just has to be used correctly, right? Mm. And I think he's right about that. I think you can't necessarily blame... You can't blame VR for being bad because the idea of VR is not bad. It's the way that people use it, I think, is the important part of that yeah. process. So
it definitely seems like it's here to stay this time.
Well, they're putting enough money into it. so I think those investors want to see a little bit of an ROI.
I think so.
And there is going to be a big bubble, I think. I think that basically it's going to be .com all over again, you know?
Have you ever seen the hype curve?
Oh, yeah.
The hype curve. So in 3D printing, for example, is just past the
hype curve?
Just past the sort of in the trough of disillusionment right now.
Okay.
Which is, it will find its uses, right?
If sure.
You come into the trough and then you come out and you say, okay, here are the actual things that it's useful for. We're going to, these are the applications that
when,
work.
When people started 3D printing guns, people went crazy, right?
People went crazy.
Yeah.
Very crazy.
Yeah.
So, and the same thing will happen with VR is everybody will think it will solve every single problem.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a time period, and probably has already had a couple of these cycles where it didn't meet the expectations, but then the real applications will come out and they will be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I think there's some really interesting use cases. And I love, you know, just like when we're looking at here, like we did a scan to see where every nail goes. That's fascinating to me. Or we blew up, you know, we 3D printed a concept and then blew it up to meet a full sculpture. And I love the fact that you guys are involved in art or the prosthetic. So there's always these interesting things that you never expect to come out of scanning, right? Mm-hmm. You would think like, oh, you just scan stuff. And it's like, yeah, that way you have a digital model of it. Yeah, but for what? There's a lot of different uses for that. And since you guys have been doing it for 20 years, you're definitely past the hype curve, right?
Yeah.
So that's a cool idea. But I think like 3D printing had a certain idea. And I think VR had a certain concept where like, I love those interesting ideas. And one of them that came up was someone that had a problem with his eyes where it was a real lazy eye problem. Mm-hmm. And they put an Oculus on and had him play a game where they dimmed one eye on purpose to force the other eye to be stronger, and pretty much cured his lazy eye problem and allowed it to basically like, oh, as his eye was getting better and better and better, they would you know, reduce that and it gets stronger. And so basically just putting on a VR headset and playing a video game for an hour a day, yep, or whatever it was, allowed that person to cure a specific thing. And that's not virtual reality for virtual reality. That's using the technology through virtual reality to basically solve a physical ailment, which
and
I think.
And in the same way, there's a ton of research that can be done into human perception. The same way they did when I think people were wearing an Oculus and they delayed the video feed by 2 seconds.
Oh, that's horrible.
It's horrible, but you should find the video. I need to find it online. It's hilarious. They're trying to flip eggs and bowl.
Yeah.
But it's just this amazing peek into human perception that like just, I think it's maybe even just a second, and their lives are completely destroyed.
I bet you if you gave it to a younger kid, they would solve it very,
very
quickly.
And just figure out the time delay.
So this guy, this is a similar story about our brain. It has nothing to do with VR, but he took his bicycle and reversed the gearing on it so that when you turn the wheel one way, the wheel will go the other way, and see how quickly his brain could adapt to that new steering. And took him like 3 days to be able to ride the bicycle again, and he challenged people like $100 to ride his bicycle, and they're like, they couldn't do it, and they're like, I'll figure it out, and it's like, couldn't do it, and then gave it to his son, who was like, you know, 12, 13, probably Tristan's age here, and 10 minutes later, he started riding that bike. It's like, jeez, because the brain at that age is still
It's still learning.
Yeah,
you haven't run all the ruts through it yet.
Yeah, I love young brains because they're like they're wired. They go to school, and they're all they do all day long is learn, right? And so they want to learn because that's what they're used to doing, right? Yep. So yeah, one thing I learned in school is learn how to learn.
Yeah, exactly. That's the
Yeah, it's cool. So the other thing what we're talking about, VR, just before that. Oh, the brain perception. Oh, did you ever see the one where they take the person and they have a guy and a girl and they switch their bodies?
No, but I want to.
So the guy puts on the VR headset and then they put the camera on the woman, and whatever he sees, it's the woman. So she's not actually in a VR headset, but she's looking at what he's doing and mimicking all of the motions and is like, oh, these are my hands and they don't really look like my hands and I don't know what I'm doing. And it's like, it was just like, you know, I don't want to. Yeah, it was very weird. Obviously, it's an out-of-body experience.
It's an out-of-body experience.
And understanding that and how that works in VR is really cool. I think there's a lot of great stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think those are the kind of things that bubble out of these technologies that are really, just like the WikiHuman stuff, is the things that will bubble out of that are the...
Well, hopefully. That's my goal, at least, is figure out what it is. I don't know. I like Birdie, too. Do you ever see the Birdie one? Someone made like a plywood bird thing that you attach yourself to with a VR headset. Okay. And you flap your wings and you basically are flying in VR. And you can like... And the whole thing rocks as you rock down, so it creates and basically you feel like a bird.
That's
like
awesome.
Really beautiful.
Every kid's dream.
Yeah, yeah, flying. Yeah,
I'm sure he's Googling it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. All right, we're actually right at an hour, so it's perfect. Anything else you want to let us know about? I think we talked about a lot.
Yeah, we did.
Good. Well, cool. So I'd love to be able to make sure that people check out the website for the podcast. We'll put some pictures up there, some interesting ideas, if you're able to share some of those with us, and whatever links to we can to include in there. So that'd be awesome. All right, guys.
Great. Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. I found it.
What did you find?
I found the fly
the birdie.
Bird.
The fly birdie thing?
VR powered.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You should. Yeah, that'd be cool. We should have one for the office. For no reason at all. All right, guys. Thank you.
Cool, thanks.